I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. President Biden has introduced several ambitious plans to pump trillions of dollars into this country's economy. Today, we'll examine his latest, the American Family Plan. Priced at $1.8 trillion, it will provide an additional 4 years of free education, fund child care, and provide additional support for families. We'll ask how comfortable Americans are with spending trillions and how the president proposes to pay for it all. Later, Greg Schieffer has been working on a documentary series about his hometown of Olathe for years now. Now that project is reaching its conclusion. We'll hear about the Johnson County town's intriguing history and ask why Schieffer decided to put it to film. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. After releasing the American Rescue Plan soon after coming into office and the American Jobs Plan this March, President Joe Biden has introduced yet another sweeping bill.
In my view, we also need to make a once-in-a-generation investment in our families and our children. That's why I've introduced the American Families Plan tonight, which addresses four of the biggest challenges facing American families and, in turn, America.
The $1.8 trillion American Families Plan does a lot. It would involve implementing expansive new education measures, including universal pre-K, 2 years of free community college to anyone who wants it, and funding for historically black colleges and universities. But that only scratches the surface of what the bill would accomplish. It would push $225 billion into child care, another $225 billion into paid family and medical leave, and $600 billion into expanding the child tax credit. So let's get into the details of what exactly this bill does. Joining us now to break it down for us is Heather Long from the Washington Post. Heather, good morning. Nice to have you.
Hi, great to be here.
You know, these plans all sound the same here. There's the American Jobs Plan, the American Rescue Plan, and now the American Families Plan. But they are pretty different. One was to boost the economy after COVID. Another was aimed at infrastructure. And this one, the American Families Plan, does a lot for people, Heather. Tell us about how this one is different.
It's hugely different in the sense that it's really meant to, they call it the care economy package or the family economy package. And you did a great job summarizing a lot of the different components of this bill. But what it's really meant to do from an economic perspective is make it easier for Americans to work, particularly women in the United States. So the United States doesn't just lag behind European countries with the number of women, particularly moms in the workforce. We also lag behind Canada, Japan, a number of other nations. And this hurts our growth. You know, at the end of the day, growth in the United States or any country is how many people are working times how productive they are, gives you the growth of the overall economy. And so really what this plan is meant to do with the pre-K, getting the 3 and 4 year olds to school, with making those investments in childcare more affordable and doing paid parental leave as well as paid family leave. So if somebody, maybe an elder member of your family gets sick, you could also qualify for time off. It is to make it easier to have kids in the United States and to be a working parent. And that will hopefully boost the number of working parents and hopefully overall growth.
You know, there's no question here. This is one big expansion of governmental support for families, right?
Exactly. And the White House is really betting that a lot of these individual policies are popular. I can remember 10 years ago in my first media job, listening to military leaders come and make the pitch that we needed to be investing more in preschool education in the country in order to lift the overall education levels of the nation. So a lot of this stuff, paid parental leave, of course, you know, even Republican, there's been a number of Republicans who've been advocating for various paid parental leave plans too. So a lot of these issues are bipartisan, kind of common sense issues. The question is, do we have the aptitude to all do it at once? Mm. These are big price tags. This is a lot of change happening all at one time. You know, that's why you're seeing these comparisons to, is Biden trying to do something like FDR did coming out of the Great Depression, right, when he did that New Deal? Is this sort of a 21st century New Deal where we would like to see an expansion of government? And I'll just make one more point, and that is, we just did a poll at the Washington Post with ABC News, and what really jumped out at me is we asked this question about whether people support and want bigger government with more services or smaller government with fewer services, sort of the Reagan-esque mantra. And it's really interesting. It basically breaks down by age and race. And so people under 40, you know, who spent most of their lives in two deep recessions, overwhelmingly support larger government with more services, something like the Biden plan. Same with non-white Hispanics and African Americans, overwhelmingly supporting this larger government role versus older Americans still favoring more of that Reagan-esque mantra.
But it is interesting. I mean, this idea that we're sitting here talking about trillion-dollar price tags, America suddenly, you know, seems at least somewhat comfortable, at least a portion of the country, with these trillion-dollar price tags. What brought about that change, do you think?
You're right. It's been a huge, dramatic shift, and really just a shift in the last few years. I think a couple of different things. Number one is we have spent more and more money, and that's true under both Republican and Democratic presidents. It sort of started under George W. Bush with the war spending and the agriculture spending, and then it, of course, grew under President Obama, and then under President Trump with the tax cut bill. So we sort of know we can do it, and so I think people have become more comfortable. Voters don't, you know, voters tell you they care about the debt and the deficit, but really they tend not to vote on that issue, right, politicians. So there's sort of a political reality. But on the economic side, this is probably where the bigger shift has occurred. Interest rates are so low right now. Anybody who's tried to buy a house or finance a new car or even get a business loan, you know, we basically have zero Federal Reserve interest rate, which means the, you know, mortgage rates are sitting around 3%. So these are historic lows. So it's super cheap right now to borrow money. And there was this great fear that people would just stop buying U.S. debt around the world. And actually the opposite has happened. What we're seeing is when the economy dips, like what happened last year in the Great Recession in 2008-09, people around the world flocked to U.S. debt because they saw it as so much safer, even than Europe or Japan or other parts of the world. So there's huge demand for our debt, and there's no sign that's going to stop, and it's very cheap to borrow. So that's why a lot of Democrats and certainly the White House are arguing now is the time to go big. Now is the time to make these investments.
We're talking about President Joe Biden's American Families Plan. I guess the question then becomes, how does the president propose to pay for this, Heather? I know he's looking at tax increases here.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously, that's controversial. Republicans are already drawing a red line saying, no, we don't want to support these. And even on the Democratic side, obviously, there's a lot of discussion of that Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. And he's acknowledged and already made comments to The Washington Post and other places that he does not feel comfortable with the extent of the tax hikes in this bill. Let me say a couple things. First of all, we were just talking about the debt. You have to give Biden credit. He is proposing $4 trillion of additional spending between the physical infrastructure on roads and bridges and pipes and the internet and on those, the family plan, you know, the extended education and paid parental leave and these things. But he would pay for most of it if all those tax increases were enacted. So at least he's trying to pay for it and not add hugely to the debt. I think a lot of the debate is going to come down to what are the actual numbers. So for instance, there's three big tax increases to pay for these plans. Number one is lifting the corporate tax rate. It was cut under the Trump administration to 21%. So from 35 to 21, biggest corporate tax cut in US history. Biden is proposing taking that to 28. If it went to 25 tomorrow, a few CEOs would be surprised or upset.
So he wants to split the difference the president does between where Trump was and where it was previously.
Right. But I think where the debate is going to center is between 25 and 28.
Mm-hmm.
So right now it's 28. Similarly, there's the proposal to roll back the Trump tax cut for rich families making $400,000 a year or more. So they would take that from 37 back to 39.6. Not huge opposition to that at the moment. And then the last one that where there's probably the most debate and opposition is the capital gains tax. This would only apply to people making $1 million or more a year, but it would double the capital gains tax. And why does that matter so much? You know, capital gains tax is on people's investments. So this is the money that, you know, the Warren Buffetts of the world are taking and they're investing mm-hmm. in new companies, in new ideas. And so there is a little bit of a fear that that level, that doubling, such a high increase could slow investment in the economy and, you know, hurt growth a little bit.
And Heather, the impact on low income folks and the middle class would be what?
This would be a huge boost, particularly to lower class or, you know, lower income Americans, in the sense that, as you were describing, this is you'd get more child care benefits and access to these universal preschool programs. But the real kicker is this plan, if enacted as it's written, and obviously it's going to probably be tweaked a little bit in Congress, it does provide those $3,000 a year for every child of Americans earning more or less $115,000 or less. Would receive a $3,000 payment from the government per child every year. If the child's under six, you'd get $3,600. So that's a pretty big child benefit. Many other countries do something similar, but the United States has never had something that large. And you know, that it's seen as a huge anti-poverty measure in the United States. So that would be a game changer for a lot of families in the U.S.
So the president, Heather, is really trying to close this wealth gap, this disparity between the richest Americans and the rest of us then here with a couple of these bold moves.
That's right. You know, the wealth gap is harder to change because that's obviously money that people have garnered over generations in some case. But what he is trying to do is close a little bit of the income gap. So that's how much people are earning every year. And in that sense, by giving these families of kids these payments, these $3,000 payments, that's certainly a huge boost, you know, equivalent to raising somebody's, you know, hourly wage several dollars. There's also some extension of tax cuts in this package, so it would make it easier to continue to buy the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act health insurance plans. The subsidies would remain quite generous. And there's also for families who are on the earned income tax credit. So this applies to a lot of low working mm-hmm. class Americans, would continue to receive the extra generous EITC that has been in place during the pandemic. So all of this basically is a fancy way of saying a really big income hike for people earning certainly $50,000 a year or less.
I'm visiting with Heather Long from the Washington Post. And just to your last point, this is a huge bite of the apple. I mean, we're taking on so many of the concerns that some mainly Democratic politicians have been expressing for so many years. We're doing them all at once here. It really does cause you to step back a little bit here.
A reality that of politics today. Basically, Democrats, because they have 50 seats in the Senate and not more, they can really only do two more big bills. And even that's kind of a stretch. They thought they could only do one more, and then they, you know, looked closely at the laws, and they think they can do two more through this reconciliation package, which is a fancy way of saying passing something with 50 votes, with Democrat-only
right.
votes.
Right.
So that's why they're trying to throw everything into these two bills. You know, they hope they can get some Republican votes on the physical infrastructure side. The White House is open and is currently talking with Republicans to see if there's, you know, something they could pare down or something they could tweak enough to make it a more of a bipartisan bill. But the idea is the second plan, the one that we've been talking about, that would do these big income transfers to lower income Americans and the free 2 years of community college and the parental leave, that's almost certainly going to be a Democratic only bill. But the problem is after that, the White House doesn't really have a lot more ammunition.
I was going to say there does seem to be lessons learned here. President Biden, reflecting back on his experience as vice president to Barack Obama, where they tried to play with Republicans, include them in negotiations, and it just didn't work out. And you get the sense here that the Democrats are saying, we're willing to go it alone if that's what it takes, because you guys aren't going to support us anyway.
Amen. I think you summarized it well. Biden has definitely learned from his prior time in the White House. You've summarized the political calculation, which is, that trying to bend too much and pare things down too much is not worth it. There's also kind of an economic calculation here, and that is this. If you listen, I thought one of the most interesting comments from the White House team and the press secretary, Jen Psaki, in the last few weeks, is they made a comment that they want things to be big enough that Americans feel it, that people talk. They literally said they want people to talk about it at the dinner table. Huh. And again, that's sort of an economic difference between what happened after the Great Recession, when they did that big sort of almost $800 billion package, and they thought they had done so much. But most Americans said they couldn't feel it, and they felt that most of the money went to a bank bailout, which isn't quite true. But that's why they're going so big this time and loading so much that would help sort of working class Americans, with the hope that people can tangibly see a difference in their lives and even the next year or two.
Heather Long from The Washington Post is my guest. We're talking about President Biden's American Families Plan that does a whole bunch of things, universal pre-K education, 2 years free community college, tax credits, child care, family and medical leave, lots of different elements here. If you have questions about what this might mean for you, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Heather, you mentioned West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin again. Obviously a key vote. He's a Democrat, but he has strong, more conservative leanings than a lot of Democrats do. I guess the question becomes, what's he willing to accept? Because he may be the most important vote of all here.
Exactly. He is definitely the most watched person in Washington, D.C. right now. It's kind of funny to watch reporters just align almost like a duckling's trailing him down the hallway when he walks around Congress. So, at the moment, he's kind of trying to walk. At the moment, he said, look, he wants to see the White House and congressional leadership focus on the physical infrastructure bill. Remember, West Virginia is famous for spending on its roads from its prior senators who got a lot of money for the state of West Virginia for road construction. Mm-hmm. So, he wants to see that as a bipartisan package. And he has voiced some concern already about the tax increase going, for instance, the corporate rate going all the way back to 28%. He would like to see it potentially somewhere a little lower than that. So, I think the key is the White House has said, and President Biden himself has said several times, that he is willing to negotiate, particularly on that package. If I had to bet today, and things change, constantly in Washington, I think what the plan is at the moment, what I'm hearing, is they would like to try to do the physical infrastructure package. That's the $2.3 trillion package with bipartisan support. They know that bill will probably get smaller and be tweaked and maybe not have as many tax increases. Mm-hmm. So they would do that, hopefully with a few Republican votes. And then they would try to pass this bigger package, kind of like what we've been talking about, with Democrat-only votes. And they would try to throw everything else into that second package.
It really is an amazing moment in Washington. You say the timeline for this plan is a little strange. How is that?
on a couple of different levels. On the budget side, as I said, the president is trying to pay for things, but typically in Washington, and in the prior administration got hammered for this a lot too, you have to pay for things over 10 years. So however much money goes out, there should be the same revenues coming in over the decade. This plan technically spends most of the money in the first 8 years, funny 8 years, and then it has the revenues coming in over 15 years. Does that make a huge difference? On paper, no, but realistically, a lot of times tax and hikes do not last 15 years. Things get changed, the revenues don't actually come in. I think the second more important point for listeners when I talk about a fuzzy or a hand-wavy timeline is some of this stuff doesn't start right away. So for instance, a lot of people are very excited about the United States maybe finally getting paid parental leave, you know, up to 12 weeks of paid parental leave that mm-hmm. people could take off after the birth of a child, just like pretty much every other country has. And if you read closely what the White House put out, they do not guarantee those 12 weeks until 10 years later, so in 2031. So that's a long time before that would be fully phased in. Similarly, we were speaking about those $3,000 payments that would go to a lot of families earning, you know, right around $100,000 or less. That would only last through 2025. So we're talking about basically 4 to 5 years of payments, and then it would stop. It would cut off. And so there's questions, a lot of questions in DC. Why does some stuff take so long to get going and other stuff stop after a handful of years? And I think that's where a lot of the debate will also center once Congress gets its hands on the details.
I wonder about two concerns as we talk here, Heather, about this package. One is inflation, and the other is Washington's and the federal government's ability to implement all these different parts of this American Families Plan. Let's take inflation first. What is the concern there?
Well, you're already seeing some signs of inflation. Anybody who's tried to buy a home lately, in your area too, and certainly around the country, mm-hmm. huge, you know, spike in home values. Rental cars right now, it's hard to get a rental car for any price. I just tried to get one the last few days, and it's the most I've ever paid and the cheapest car I've ever gotten. And yeah. I was so thankful to get one because it was literally like speed walking me versus this other guy running to the last car on the lot.
Wow.
And so, and meat prices are up. So beef prices are up about 10% from a year ago. Pork prices are up about 6%. So people are starting to feel this inflation, and it's happening at the moment because we've got a hot economy, if you will. Mm-hmm. People are anxious to get out and spend again. People are buying things again. So in that sense, it's a good sign for the economy, but you can almost have too much of a good thing, like eating too much ice cream. So we're starting to see some of that overheating sign in the economy. The question in the debate is, can the economy handle $4 trillion more dollars being pumped in right now? And the White House says, yes, it can, that these are long-term investments we need to make. They shouldn't be seen as short-term stimulus, and that we have a very good track record of keeping these price increases, keeping inflation under control. They see this inflation in the home prices and the car and the meat prices as something that will go away after a few months as things settle down. You know, but it's a risk. And that's why we talk about it as a gamble. We have not pumped this much money into a peacetime economy before, mm-hmm. and this, you know, this scale and this speed. And that's why we don't know if it could. Do we think it'll be a repeat of the 1970s double-digit inflation? Probably not. But do we think it'll be higher than what the 1.8% very modest inflation we've had for years? Yeah. And you know, where do you fall on that spectrum? Is it too much, or can we get to a Goldilocks level?
And how about when implementing all these different programs? Can Washington do it all, Heather?
I mean, mind-boggling. Look how well they did in the past year. You know, some things they did well on, other things were a complete, you know, disaster, at least when they started to get them out. You think back to those small business loans, a lot of stumbles there, even getting out those first stimulus payments or unemployment. I mean, I have written articles about how it took, you know, almost a year for some people to get their unemployment money. And now we're talking about implementing a lot of new programs. These payments to the children, the $3,000 payments would be running through the Internal Revenue Service. Those are supposed to start in July. We'll see how that goes. On top of that, it sounds great, and a lot of people support doing 2 years of free community college and, you know, having 3 and 4 year olds, all 3 and 4 year olds in some sort of pre-K program. But the reality is, do we have enough spots open? Right. And the federal government has to convince every state. You know, most education decisions are made at the state level. So is the, you know, is your state going to sign up for these programs and put up money? States have to put up money, to a little bit of money, to join some of these initiatives alongside the federal government. Let's remember back to the Affordable Care Act. You know, there's still about a dozen states that haven't signed up for Medicaid expansion.
Well, right, here in Missouri and Kansas, right. Absolutely.
So, yeah. So a lot of things would have to go right for all of this to be implemented, certainly in the next 5 years.
He also wants to spend $45 billion on nutrition. Any sense of what that would do?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I'm sorry I didn't bring that up earlier. My understanding is this is to continue to expand, kind of like what we've seen in the pandemic. I think everyone has been affected by seeing those long lines at food banks, those cars after cars, you know, talking to people, and I'm sure you've been on your radio program, right, too, for the first time ever going to food banks, and really, I think it was very eye-opening for people, the amount of hunger in this nation. And so, the nutrition programs, a lot of that money would go towards what were currently in place during the pandemic, which is money to help support children, particularly in the summer months when they're not in school, and to expand, basically so kids can get lunch and breakfast, and people wouldn't have to pay for that anymore. Hmm. So that's what a lot of it is. I think there's some understanding of that need after, right, the pandemic.
A lot of my students, I teach up at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, here in town, Heather, and my students are wondering, is student debt forgiveness for the loans they've taken out, is that a part of this package?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I get a lot of emails about this too. The answer is no. It is not. So a couple of things got left out here. You know, you and I were talking about how this plan feels like it has almost all the Democratic wish list initiatives, but actually it doesn't. It leaves out quite a few things. For instance, the $15 minimum wage. There's some industries in this bill, like preschool teachers, who they're suggesting should get 15, but it is not a push for universal $15 minimum wage across the country. There is no student debt forgiveness in this plan. And a lot of Democrats, like Bernie Sanders, are upset that there's no expansion of Medicare really in this plan. They wanted to see the age drop to 60 or 50. That doesn't happen.
Okay, that's Heather Long from the Washington Post. And Heather, you're just a wonder. Your knowledge of this is so impressive. And thank you again for taking some time with us. Very much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
Heather Long from the Washington Post. After a short break, we'll come back and talk with a man who's made a series of documentaries about the city of Olathe. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Greg Sheffer has been working on documentary after documentary about his hometown of Olathe for years, creating an impressive series of historical films dedicated to telling the city's story. He joins the show now to talk about some of the highlights of the doc series and what he's most proud of looking back on it. Greg Sheffer, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Why are you so interested in documenting Olathe, Greg?
Well, I'm super passionate about the humanities. I've always been that way. I think it's one of the most important fields of study. It teaches us about who we are and connects us to one another and throughout time. And I've always been that way since I was a kid. And I grew up in Olathe. I went to Olathe schools. Went to college in Olathe. I studied history and education. Student taught at Olathe North High School's history. So I've always been surrounded by history, and I was in my mid-30s, and I started discovering these amazing stories that took place here in little old Olathe, Kansas, that were these profound historical events. And I knew very little or nothing about, and no one was talking about. They weren't articulated anywhere. Things like the trail system. We all know the Santa Fe Oregon Trail. We played Oregon Trail on the computer in junior high and died of dysentery. But I had no clue. Lone Elm campsite sat out here in southern Olathe, and it was a huge, important first stop on the trail system. I had no clue. No clue William Quantrill raided Olathe in 1862, a year before he raided Lawrence. Huh. Rode into town with 150 horsemen and killed some people and stirred some things up. A huge historical event, and I had never heard that.
So you're saying, bottom line, is Olathe is interesting enough that it's worth your time?
That's what I discovered is, out of Johnson County, Olathe by far has the most dynamic, profound history in Johnson County, which is a huge chunk of the Kansas City metro area. And it doesn't get that attention. It's kind of a bedroom community today. It's a little, boring today, but the history is profound and it needs to be told. And I had that passion. I have that skill as a filmmaker to articulate these stories, and that's sort of the genesis of this project.
And bottom line is, you say that Olathe has the most interesting local history of any of its neighbors. Tell me more about that.
Well, it's older, and so it sort of was very much involved in the Civil War. You know, this predates Overland Park. This predates Lenexa. So it has that going for it. It's a community that started on its own and got swallowed up by the metro. So I think that lends itself to having its own unique dynamic history. And so I would, again, it's my opinion, but I would put it up against any historical story of any community in Johnson County.
So how did you get started on this project?
Well, I had the idea, and I'm a filmmaker, but I like to do things right. And I think if you watch the series, you'll see that we put a lot of effort to make these look really good. And sometimes that costs a little bit of money. So I went around town trying to figure out how to do this. And everybody told me to talk to Bob Courtney. And I was like, Bob who? And Bob is a longtime president of the Olathe Historical Society, kind of Mr. Olathe history. And I met with him. And we just hit it off. And he saw the vision for a whole series of films on the history of Olathe. And he's acted as executive producer for this whole series. And then he brought along the Olathe Historical Society, which has been a partner with me. They're the fiduciary. They oversaw the whole project. They own the films. That's how it started. And it's just been this great partnership over the last decade.
So where did the money come from?
Our first films were sponsored by a woman in Olathe who grew up here. She has since passed away, but her and her husband were wealthy. They gave a lot of money to various projects that involved the humanities in the story of Olathe. And she wrote our first check and gave some more money. We also were involved with the Johnson County Heritage Trust Fund, which is no longer available, and then also private donors giving to the film. We've raised, we've done 17 films. We're working on our 18th. So we've funded 18 films and raised, I think it's close to $700,000 to do this series.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's been a team effort, I gather.
Yeah. And it's those connections to the Historical Society and Bob Courtney's involvement with various groups and people that were able to, fund this series.
I understand that these films have been included in some Olathe schools, social studies classes. How did that come about?
Well, when we first started the project, we brought on Maureen Donegan, who at the time was the social studies coordinator for Olathe School District. And she made sure that the films got presented to educators. She wrote curriculum to go along with the films. She oversaw like teacher in service. They would provide opportunity for teachers to come and learn about the film series and get the curriculum. So Maureen played a huge role in that. And that was part of, the history of me growing up in Olathe schools and never seeing this stuff or hearing about it. Our films are for everybody, but I'd specifically set out to make them consumable for kids, junior high school kids. They're 7 minutes. I think our longest film is 18 minutes. So it's not like to sit down and watch an hour and a half Ken Burns or a 6-hour Ken Burns series to know about your town. It's just these little snippets that can incite people to understand the story of this community.
So as you made these films then, Greg, you're recreating some really big historical moments. How did you go about ensuring accuracy?
That was through the Historical Society. So the Historical Society oversaw that. Bob was involved in that. But when we did write a script, we brought in various subject area experts to oversee the script and make sure that the accuracy was there. We did take some artistic license and say film on the Mahaffey family or the film on William Quantrill. Mm-hmm. And we make that disclaimer at the beginning of the film. You know, we did use a little artistic license, but some of these, most of all of these events and most of the words these actors are saying are documented in history.
Greg Scheffer is my guest. He's written and produced a series of documentary films about the city of Olathe and its surprisingly rich history. We're going to listen to a few clips in just a moment here, Greg, but what are some of your favorite moments that you've been able to document here?
Well, I think we're going to hear our civil rights film. It's called There Shall Come a Day. We'll hear a clip from that. That's by far my favorite film. I think, you know, when you set out to do something, this one reason I think American culture has an aversion to history is because some of that history is dark and we don't like to hear that. And Olathe has, you know, a dark history. A lot of great stuff happened in Olathe, but there are these slivers of a dark history. And I wanted to tell that story as well. And so the systemic racism that took place in Olathe is presented in this film and told first person. And I'm very proud that this story got told. This is my favorite film, the civil rights film. I think cinematically, the film on William Quantrill, we were able to recreate a lot of the raid, the film on the lynching of Burt Dudley. It's a non-racial lynching that took place in 1916, shot it black and white, real film noir looking. Wow. Those are my two favorite films as far as a cinematic standpoint, but the civil rights film stands supreme in my book.
Well, let's go to some of these films, clips that we have here. We're going to talk about some of the ones that you just cited as some of your favorites. Let's go to the clip of Quantrill's raid. You said this was from 1862, Greg. Do I have that right?
Yes, correct.
And this is a year before the raid on Lawrence, the Lawrence Massacre then.
Yes, this was a much smaller raid. Lawrence was 400 horsemen. This was about 150. They only killed 12 men. This is prior to Quantrill's men burning and destroying property. They stole, but they weren't burning buildings at this point. So not a lot of Olathe was destroyed, but 12 men were killed. And this is September of 1862. The Lawrence raid was August of 1863.
Why did Quantrill want to raid Olathe? What was he trying to do?
Well, it was, that border war era is so fascinating to me, and it was a tit for tat world. Somebody does something to one side, the other side has revenge. So it was an act of revenge. History is motivated and people are motivated in history. And Perry Hoy was a guy that rode with Quantrill, and he was captured at a little battle that took place at Tate's farm. And the Federals took him to Leavenworth and shot Perry Hoy without a trial. They didn't even imprison him. They just executed him. And this enraged Quantrill. And so from some of the diaries of his men, we know this made him really mad. And he's like, let's head to Olathe to kill 10 men to avenge the death of Perry Hoy. And that's what they did.
Well, let's listen to a clip here from this film. I filled my bill, Quantrill's raid of Olathe.
Near midnight on September 6th, Quantrill and his men had reached the outskirts of Olathe. They had already killed 10 men. Frank Cook and brothers John and James Judy were among the dead.
Captain, militia's already formed in the square. Must have got wind of us coming. Civilians are unaware.
Take 60 men, form a cordon around the town. No one in or out, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir. Come on.
All right, boys. Right in. File left and right. Take immediate possession of the town. Harm no women or children. And kill only if resisted. Let's ride.
How long did Quantrill control Olathe?
It was just from the early morning hours. I think if memory serves me right, 1 or 2 a.m. was when they rode it in town, and they rode out before dawn. So just a few hours.
And the point he was making was what?
Well, it was again for revenge. And again, when these bushwhackers and even the Jayhawkers going over to Missouri in that era, if you're doing something, you might as well benefit from it. So not only was it revenge, but his men also took a whole lot of stuff out of town, destroyed some of the printing presses so that word couldn't get out. You know, the whole action was based on revenge, but they're going to maximize it.
Wow. Okay, we have a second clip here. This is about the lynching of Burt Dudley. You mentioned this one before. Tell us, who was Burt Dudley? Why was he lynched?
In 1916, Burt Dudley was hired by two German immigrant farmers, a couple in Stillwell. Gertrude and Henry Mueller were their names. And suddenly, a young man is going around town selling things and calling himself Henry Mueller, and people knew it wasn't Henry Mueller. So the sheriff was called out, and this individual was Burt Dudley, who had been hired by them as a farmhand. And the sheriff discovered the bodies of Henry and Gertrude in the storm cellar and arrested Burt Dudley. He confessed to the murder, was taken to downtown Olathe, tried and convicted and sentenced to a life in prison in Lansing. There was no death penalty in the state of Kansas at that time, but that didn't sit well with the community, farming community of Stillwell. So early morning hours in 1916, about 70 farmers came into town, downtown Olathe, stormed the jail, overpowered the sheriff, yanked Burt Dudley out of jail, took him, interestingly enough, to Dudley Road, strung him up over a telephone pole, hung him, and shot him 16 times.
Wow.
And just disappeared into the night. And no one was ever convicted or tried for this lynching. So just a fascinating event in 1916.
Let's listen. And you said it was non-racial in nature, right?
Correct. Burt Dudley was white.
Let's listen to a clip here from the lynching of Burt Dudley.
After midnight on September 21st, the mob that had formed in Stillwell arrived in downtown Olathe and charged into the Johnson County Jail. Sheriff Carroll, who lived in the county jail, was awakened by the commotion, rushed toward the men, firing a warning shot. The mob kept coming, and the sheriff's second shot was deflected away as the mob overpowered him and continued toward Dudley's cell. Breaking down the cell door, they grabbed Dudley and put a noose around his neck and pulled him out of his cell.
No,
he reportedly screamed,
I didn't do it! I didn't do it, so help me God! No!
Wow. Pretty dramatic stuff.
Yeah, and that's, you know, again, when we set out to, you know, this film really, and it's one of why it's one of my favorites, is it really brings to life this dramatic history. It's not just, you know, a fading in and out of old photos. And I really want people to view a story like this and just sort of spark their imagination, if you will.
Greg Sheffer is my guest. He's filmed a series of 17 documentaries on the city of Olathe. He's working on his 18th these days right now. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Okay, let's move to your the third clip we're going to hear here. This is from your favorite film, There Shall Come a Day, Civil Rights in Olathe. And again, this is your favorite documentary. Why, Greg?
Well, I was really involved with Second Baptist Church in Olathe, which is a black church here in town and has a long history. In fact, Second Baptist started as First Baptist in Olathe back in the 19th century. And when the white community started a Baptist church, they didn't want to be called Second Baptist, so they stole the name. And that's why, again, a little part of the racism of Olathe, that this was Second Baptist now. But I worked really close with Dr. Bobby Love, a great guy, the pastor there, and he was able to find some of these people that are in the film for us. So we screened a film for that church, a little luncheon. They were the first to see the film just because of their involvement. And it was one of those times, you know, when you're a filmmaker and you produce something and an audience is clearly moved by it. I've had that happen a few times, and this is one of them where there was just this like glow,
right,
that came over the audience that someone has finally told our story. And this is a type of story that doesn't really, you know, there's not going to be a park or a plaque somewhere to tell this story. And so I think that's why this is my favorite.
Set this clip up for us. What is this this film about?
These are two individuals that grew up in Olathe. They're just a generation before me. They were in high school in the 1960s when there was still this sort of systemic racism going on. The schools had just been integrated, and Connie Richardson and Albert Robinson are talking about their experiences in the community and also connecting, you know, how that affected them as high school students.
Okay, let's listen to a clip here from There Shall Come a Day, Civil Rights in Olathe.
Through the efforts of Ralph Dennis, Olathe schools began incorporating Black students into their sports teams in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Dennis sometimes bought shoes and equipment for African-American students who couldn't afford it. Though even this pioneering educator and others who supported his efforts, like Olathe High School track coach Lester Sales, could do nothing about the racism they encountered at athletic meets.
I was never so scared in my life. We went to Turner, Kansas and ran track. And as we were all up under the bleachers, and you know, it was three, four of us, Black track, and we set off to the side. And the kids were always, they would go up to the top of the bleachers, pour stuff on us, spit on you, and different things like that. So we kind of mingled in a little bit with the whites, but they didn't really want us in there. They wanted us on the team, but they just didn't want us in that group. And that really, it really bothered me. We got down the run, and I heard this guy leaned over to me and said, "I'm gonna kill you if you win." And that really scared me. That scared me. But I could hear Mr. Dennis and Mr. Sells in my ear telling me, you know, don't let people pull you down. If you're good, you're good no matter what. And we won that race. And afterward, we had to get on the bus quick. I mean, they were throwing stuff at us. They cussed us. They spit on us. And for a long time, I didn't want to go back and run track. I didn't want to do that anymore.
Man, it's just a reminder that these struggles took place even in, you know, out of the way places like Olathe, Kansas.
Yeah. And that's, again, I love the fact that we brought to life this story that, you know, here in Kansas, the free state, if you will, that these things happened. And, you know, and one of the things about this film I love, too, is it's fair. You know, there's this sort of air of racism going on, but there were people, like he mentions, these white teachers and coaches, Lester Sales and Ralph Dennis, who were speaking dignity into these kids' lives and helping them in enormous ways.
Let's go to some phone calls. Jake from South Kansas City. Jake, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Just a question. Do you touch on the Hire family or Hire Boot Company in any of the pieces that were done?
Greg?
Yeah, we have a film. It's called Home of the Cowboy Boot, and it covers, we interview Nan Bull, who was granddaughter of Charles Hire, in that film, and she talks all about her grandfather and the development of the modern cowboy boot and the history of Hire Boot.
Well, yeehaw, I got a pair on my 21st birthday, and I still wear them, and I'm 73. Hire boots.
That's great. And right. There's a lot of famous people that have also worn them. So,
including Jake. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for the call, Jake.
Stay negative. All right.
You
bye.
Bet. Hey, has anything as significant as the events we've already talked about, most of them are going back decades, has anything as significant as these events occurred in Olathe in the past 25 or 30 years?
Not so much. That's sort of, again, I grew up in the sort of, again, sterile Olathe. But our current film that we've started, Gary Burrell started, Garmin. This is going to be our 18th film on the story of Gary Burrell, who's co-founder of Garmin. This is the 1980s. We're going to cover his life, but Garmin really got going in the 80s, early 90s. And that's the most contemporary story we have.
So you're getting ready now to finish up working on this series of films. Why stop making them now?
Well, we originally set out with 19 films 10 years ago. That was our goal. We had a long list and we kind of narrowed it down, some based on having enough subject matter, some based on, you know, sometimes stories just don't make great films. But we've kind of exhausted a lot of the major stories. And this was our goal, to sort of, if you watch all of these films, you get the scope of Olathe history.
Greg, if people want to see them, how can they do it?
Olathe Historical Society.org would be a place to buy DVDs. I know that's kind of an archaic format. And what we're doing now is we're finishing up the series. We're going to try to get this 19th film funded and done. I think our best option right now is we're going to start a YouTube channel. Historical Society doesn't have a lot of resources, and there was never an intention to make money off these films. So to start a YouTube channel, we have not done that yet, but that'll be a place where these will have a final home.
That's Greg Scheffer. He's produced a series of documentaries about the history of Olathe. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. You've been listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We'll see you tomorrow.